session number 17155, reel 2.
Colonel Jeffs, reel 2.
Right. Yes, I was saying we had established a bridgehead near Anjou, just north of Anjou, and the Australians were the leading battalion. Now, the Chinese attacked them very heavily in the night, and the Australians had a new CO who'd come out from a transit camp, I believe, in Japan. The previous CO, Colonel Jim Green, had been killed earlier on during the advance north when they were a reserve battalion, and the North Koreans, I said earlier, used to fire over at night with SP guns and tanks, and unfortunately one shell had hit the tree on which he was sleeping, and he was killed in shrapnel. This new colonel withdrew one of his companies from the hill they were holding in view of this Chinese attack, and the Chinese mauled them very badly as they came to the bottom of the hill. This was without authority from the brigadier or anyone. The battalion second in command was a chap called Bruce Ferguson, Major Bruce Ferguson. He arrived at brigade headquarters about, I suppose, 4 o'clock in the morning with another officer to see the brigadier and complain, said, look, the battalion is in chaos. We cannot carry on with this CO. What's that effect? And the brigadier removed the CO from command on the strength of this and ordered the battalion to retake this hill. I think they had problems, because I think it was a bit too late for them to do it, but it did put the brigade in jeopardy that we'd lost this hill. Fortunately, a little later, the Chinese withdrew for no apparent reason, and they went north again. And we went gradually back to Pak Chon. It was one of those stages where the Chinese would attack and then suddenly withdraw. And we went back to Pak Chon and stayed there for a number of days. We were very short of petrol and fuel at that stage, too. We'd more or less outrun our lines of communication. And Americans had a job getting it to us. I'll digress slightly here now, because it was now getting rather cold. Temperatures were falling. We had no antifreeze, but we used some captured Russian antifreeze, which we found in large drums. We made a mistake. It was my fault. We diluted it. I thought you use it as you do the antifreeze we have in this country. But you didn't, apparently. Now, it was all right initially, but later on, as it got colder still, this stuff froze in the radiators, and we then learnt you had to put it in neat. I couldn't get any replacement tyres for my recovery vehicles, and these tyres were wearing out rapidly. Now, I did spot one day that the American 155 howitzers had the same size tyre. So I thought, well, if I can get hold of some of those, we'll be okay. The question of how to get hold of them. In Hong Kong, our wine merchants were called Beck McGregor, and they had a depot in Japan. And there was a liaison officer, Major Knight of the South Staffords, who used to come from Air Vice Marshal Boucher's headquarters, I think, in Japan, as a liaison once a week. He used to fly to and fro, and we arranged for him to bring a supply of whiskey to brigade headquarters. And it was the only whiskey in Korea, and every week we had a dozen bottles used to arrive. And it was the only whiskey in Korea. Now, we had in brigade course, and I think the brigadier used to let the battalion commanders have a bottle each, something like that. But this was very valuable. I went off to an American ordnance depot, and I found a full-bodied colonel. And I explained the situation to him, that I was short of these tyres, could he help? He said, gee, Captain, that's difficult. I don't know, I can do this. They're very costly, you know. And he said, well, I'll sign any forms you want me to. We weren't getting very far, so I said, look, I can offer you a bottle of whiskey, if that's any help. He said, gee. And he thought, and in the end, I could have had as many tyres as I wanted. I could have had another jeep, I reckon. He said, how do you sleep, Captain? I said, well, I have a little sleeping bag. He said, gee, you want an Arctic sleeping bag. So I had a lovely American Arctic sleeping bag given to me. Which came in very, very useful, because I used to sleep under my jeep. And one night I woke up, my breath had condensed on the chassis of the jeep, and you've got stalactites and stalagmites, whatever they're called, and the two, finally I found my nose was joined to the jeep chassis by ice. One couldn't do it nowadays, but one got away with it then. I was that time wearing pyjamas underneath my battle dress to try and keep warm, and so I got some rather nice American winter clothing, which came in very useful. Then later on, a few string vests and that type of thing arrived from the UK and woolly pullovers, and they gradually kitted us out in rather better kit. But initially, it was difficult. I think one reason was that we were not supposed to be in Korea then. See, originally, we were only going there until 29 Brigade arrived in the October. But with the advent of the Chinese, etc., we were held there. And so that no one had ever thought that we'd require winter clothing. But ultimately, they got some out to us. Some of the stuff they sent out initially was rather rubbishy. They sent us some mittens, which four fingers went into, and then there was a thing for the thumb. But there was no trigger finger. So people had to cut holes in these for their trigger finger. Otherwise, you couldn't fire a rifle with them. Stupid things like that. Coming back now to Anjou, I just mentioned again, the thing I remember from there was that it's a very bloody business with the civilian casualties. They came down the road that night. A lot had been hit, obviously, in this crossfire. And they were in hand carts and so on. And there was nothing we could do for them at all. We just had to send them on back. And the blood was dripping from these hand carts as they went past. And, of course, we had to inspect everyone very carefully because Chinese would quite like to try and get through in this way. And the Americans were very brutal on that kind of thing as far as allowing casualties back through their lines with civilians. They were very, very callous indeed about it. It was now getting very cold. If you poured hot water from a kettle or anything, or a tin, it froze by the time it hit the ground. And later on, around Christmas, we had 48 degrees of frost. I made some modified desert burners. I designed one and got the workshops to make them. If you remember, in the desert, people used to fill a tin with some sand and then put petrol in and then put a funnel arranged on top and light it, and the thing would come up, flames come up through the funnel, and you could brew a pot of tea on it or brew a can of water or something. Well, I modified this in that I put a pipe into the bottom of the tin and a constant supply of petrol going in through a little valve. So you could adjust the petrol going in, and so it kept on burning. You could heat tents and so on. It was really a crib of one of the American stoves that the Americans had in their big tents. And most of the battalions had these things, and they came in quite useful for heating. We got the workshops to make some of them. We insisted on shaving. The Americans didn't shave. They looked very, very scruffy. We insisted, as far as we could, on shaving. But that was difficult, because you didn't take your clothes off. You got your razor, shaved a little bit, and by which time the razor had frozen to your fingers, so you had to put them back in the warm water to get them off again. Very difficult, but we did it. We had then given to us some Trials Land Rovers. These Land Rovers sent out from the UK, six of them, and I had one. I think the battalion commanders had one each, and the brigadier had one, and so on. We found them very good. They were much warmer than the jeeps because they had doors and so on them, which the jeeps didn't have. But we did find that the brakes on them tend to fail in the very cold weather. Suddenly you put your foot down and nothing happened. Also the clutches stuck for some reason, particularly when you do a river crossing, and you had no clutch thereafter, so you had to drive it without a clutch, which is a little difficult changing gear. You have to get the revs right. But occasionally, if you got them slightly wrong, the jar was sufficient to undo the clutch, and you could drive it again the normal way. We had a great deal of problem with the Bren gun carriers. Steering is done by a cross tube business, apart from slowing one track and the other. There's a cross tube which bends the track. And they would get water in, and of course that would freeze, and the cross tube mechanism didn't work, so you couldn't steer them properly. It was interesting how the Russians got over. We also had trouble starting our vehicles in the very cold weather. And our diesel scambles, we had to keep those running all the time. You couldn't stop the engine, because if you did, you'd never restart it. You had to get a tank or something to tow one to restart it, and tanks weren't always available. But I noticed the Russian jeeps, we captured one or two of those, they had a little bracket on which you put a blow lamp under the carburetor, heating the inlet manifold, and that's how they start theirs. Very clever. We had nothing like that. Our machine guns, you couldn't put any oil on them. If you did, then they wouldn't fire. The oil just went solid. So you had to fire them without oil. And of course, that led to problems when they got really hot. You couldn't pick up a rifle with your bare hands. If you did, it froze to you. our fitters trying to repair Vertels and guns and so on. Had an awful job because they had to wear gloves all the time and trying to fiddle about with little nuts if you're adjusting tappets was the most difficult business. But if they touched the metal, then they froze to it. I did, in the meantime, borrow an extra recovery Vertel and 29 Brigade, because during the withdrawal, we sometimes had as many as 8 Vertels on tow behind each recovery Vertel. And those we couldn't tow, as I say, we blew up during the long withdrawal, because soon after this, we started back. Well, after Anjou, the Chinese again attacked. We went up to Pak Chon, then the Chinese attacked again, and we came back. And we went south of the river to a place called Kunuri. While we were there, we went into reserve, and the brigadier was ordered to take our brigade northeast to a place called Tok Chon. That was again about 15, 20 miles out in the blue. And he looked at this and the general situation. He said, "No, sir, I will not go. I can see no useful purpose in taking my brigade there," because he knew we'd be cut off, and he wasn't going to risk it. The Americans sent up the Turkish brigade instead. They went. The Americans got them there, and then they left them there and withdrew the transport. But I'll come to that later. We were then given the job of going south to Sun Chon, to hold Sun Chon, with the American 2nd Division still in Kunuri. And there was a pass, and as we went through that pass that night, it was cut by the Chinese, and we came under small arms fire as the rear of our column came through. The following day, the Middlesex were ordered to go and clear the southern half of the pass, which they did. And the 2nd Infantry Division were going to clear the northern half of the pass, join up and come through. Now, they didn't clear it properly, the Americans. If you couldn't get a jeep there, the Americans normally didn't go there. And so they didn't deploy their infantry into the high ground on either side of this pass, which the Middlesex had done. They tried to drive through. They sent tanks and guns and Vertels through. And the Chinese ultimately put explosive charge on the end of bamboo poles into the tank tracks and blew the tank tracks. That, of course, caused the tanks to slow across the road and block the pass completely, and nothing could get through. The divisional commander was a chap called General Kaiser, I think. He came through in a tank and said, "Gee, that was some ride that was," and went on, didn't attempt to fight his division out. There were two regimental combat teams north of the pass, well, some in it and the other one north. The third was commanded by Colonel Mike Michaelis. He'd been an airborne commander in the last war, and he decided to go west. He went west and then south and came out that way, and he got his RCT out. The other two RCTs were caught in this pass, and I think there were about 8 miles of packed Vertels, tanks and guns, nose to tail, and the American Air Force went up the next day and napalmed the lot to stop them falling into Chinese hands. It was an absolute massacre, terrible business. And it could have been avoided had the 2nd Infantry Division, in our opinion, could have been avoided had they deployed their infantry into the hills and cleared the Chinese from the hills, because the Chinese were not there in great strength, only a battalion or so, not great strength. The Turkish people, the brigade who had gone up to this Tok Chon place, they fought their way out. They were very, very bitter about the Americans, and the Turkish brigade commander arrived at our brigade headquarters and said, "I will not fight under American command anymore, I will only fight under British command." Further down the road, it was reported to us, although we didn't actually see it, that some of the Turks went for the Americans with their bayonets, because they were so angry. So the situation wasn't good. There was absolute panic. The American command was very, very dicey indeed. They were panicking, issuing orders and counter-order continuously. It was absolute panic stations. Now, we seldom used Korean houses, but we did on one or two occasions at that stage, and the Korean houses were of rather interesting design. They were very basic. They had mud and lath walls. The doors were sliding doors. There were a wooden frame on which they stuck, I think it was a form of rice paper, either side. So you got a kind of double glazing effect. And they were waterproof. At one end of the house was the kitchen. That was outside. and they had all the little pots and pans and things there, and the fire was there, and the fire was taken under a gully or something. It ran under the floor, the mud floor, and then up a chimney at the other end, so you had central heating. Very, very clever. Very primitive, very clever, and very effective. They had their, usually had a wall round, a kind of fence round the part of their house at the back, in which they kept their animals, and they brought those in the winter. And if they killed any off, they put them into large stone jars, together with vegetables and so on, which were in the ground and were frozen. So they had a kind of deep freeze, which they kept going out to keep them going through the winter. It was very, very clever. However, I digress slightly, but on one occasion, the brigadier used one of these houses, and his batman, very keen to keep him warm, stoked up the fire outside, and the brigadier put his carbine down with the magazines on the floor, and in the middle of the night, this ammunition went off because the floor got too hot and exploded the ammunition in his magazine. So there was a certain degree of chaos when this happened, I can tell you. Great excitement. We had now had some trouble with our trials Land Rovers in that the American engineers were doing these roads, dropped these boulders into them, and the boulders sank down, and you've got holes as well, so you've got a great mound of boulders in the middle of the road, which most vehicles would clear. But the Land Rovers had I think it was the third truss chassis member, was rather low. It stuck down, and it had it supported the rear end of the gearbox. And these chassis members would come against one of these boulders, and of course the chassis member would be torn out. So we had problems there. We got over it by re-welding chassis members in, and also putting a crash plate, which we pinched some Jeeps. It was an idea they had in Jeeps. Had a crash plate, so if it came up against this boulder, it slid over the boulder on this crash plate, and it worked. I mentioned, I think, about the brakes not working in the cold weather. Now, I mentioned Bruce Ferguson, who was the second-in-command of the Australians. He was made CO by the brigadier, and Bruce and I didn't originally get on very well together, because in the advance north, if he had a vehicle broken down, he'd expect me to go back and recover it. He'd probably leave it 50 or 100 miles back, and I couldn't send a recovery vehicle back that far. And I said, no, I can't do that, sir. If you have it's up to you to tow them in. If they've gone over on their side, then obviously we've got to go and recover them. He said, well, I'll push them over then. And, well, that's up to you, sir. However, a little later on, during the withdrawal, they were doing rear guard, and he had this Land Rover, and the Land Rovers had an electric petrol pump. And these things used to carbon up and wouldn't work. And he came to start his Land Rover, his driver came to start the Land Rover, and it wouldn't start. And we'd had this trouble I'd had it with mine, and one or two others had the trouble, and I knew what the answer was. Just carburetor and paper, into the points, clean them up, and the thing started immediately. Well, I was in Brigadier Quartz, and I heard this come over on the radio about Bruce Ferguson's Land Rover not starting. I thought, right, well, I'll go up there and deal with this. So I went myself. He was poring over a map. There were some tanks firing up, some Chinese who were coming down the valley, and he was just about to pull out, and he's poring over a map, and he looked up and saw me. Now, my code name was Bluebell. Remy on the radio is Bluebell. And he looked at me and said, Christ, King fucking Bluebell himself. But you know, I could do nothing right. Got his Jeep going, his Land Rover going. I could do nothing wrong as far as Bruce was concerned after that. The fact I had gone and not sent a fitter, I think. And it just worked. And we got on very, very well after that. We'd been joined... about then by the New Zealand gunners, who had some very old 25-pounder guns. I don't think they even had muzzle brakes fitted. They were very basic. Now, in the British Army, guns are treated like the crown jewels. You mustn't do anything to them. Everything's got to be referred back to Woolwich and so on, etc., etc. In war, of course, you alter it slightly, but I'd been used to this in peacetime. And I was driving past their gun lines one day when I saw an American unit there, an American repair truck, and they were welding up one of these guns. I got out and had a look, and they'd fired it with the stop running back in position, and it had torn a great hole in the cradle, so they were welding this up. Anything to agree with it, because the guns had to be kept firing, so one did it. But I think the people in Woolwich would have turned in their graves if they'd known such things were happening. It was a very good regiment, actually. It was commanded by Colonel Jim Moody, And I think only he and one other were regulars. All the rest were territorials. It was a very, very good regiment. We arrived back in the area of Weejongbu, which is about 14 or 15 miles north of Seoul, for Christmas. And we were then in reserve. We had a slight problem. The Americans gave us enormous turkeys, which wouldn't fit in our little cookers. So we had to get the workshops to make some bigger cookers out of petrol drums and so on, which were to roast these things. At New Year's Eve, there was a Republic of Korean division in the line in front of us, and the Chinese attacked, and this Korean division broke. And I remember we'd had a little party in our mess tent. Jimmy Stewart, the Argyle brigade major, coming around and saying, "Get up, Reggie," and he went round everyone, waking us all up. They'd broken through. And sure enough, the Chinese had broken through. And when you looked out, all the ground was covered in snow. We were on a bit of a hill. There was a track running down. It was a so-called main road. And it was one mass of troops retreating down it. And we tried to stop them and turn them around. We managed to stop some of them, but the rest just went on. There was no control of them at all. The problem was, amongst them were some Chinese, who we couldn't, of course, identify. And they got further back and caused absolute chaos amongst some American units further back. But they didn't bother us, fortunately. We hung on there for a short while, and then we withdrew, and the Australians had rather nasty business with these Chinese. They were cut off for a time, but managed to get out through them. And we ended up doing rearguard on Seoul. And we pulled out of there in the late afternoon and went south of the Han River. The brigade headquarters pulled out. And our brigadier, who's an awfully nice fellow, he had a caravan, which was mounted on a Bedford QL chassis. And this damn thing didn't arrive with the column. It had been left in Seoul. So I had to go back and see if I could find this thing and recover. I took a section of the defence platoon with me, because things were getting rather dicey in Seoul then. But the brigadier said to me, "Reggie, do see if you can find it, because it's got all my worldly possessions in it." He didn't say, "Go and get it." He said, "Do see if you can find it. It's got all my worldly possessions. Will you do anything for a man who talked to you like that?" Wonderful commander. I went back. In fact, we found the thing, and his radiator had frozen up. Because even with the Russian antifreeze in neat, we found that if you started an engine and revved it up, the fan would draw cold air through, and it was fit to freeze the antifreeze in the radiator, and then, of course, it stopped the circulation. And his driver had done just that. So we got the thing going and got it back. The following morning, we were south of the river. The battalions were coming out, and again, the brigadier refused an American order. He was asked to hold on until late afternoon. He said, "No, I'm in close contact. It would be very dangerous to do so, and I'm not doing so." And we, in fact, pulled out the battalions from Seoul. And we went south then down to Suwon. That's right, which is south of Seoul. And then across country a bit. And by that time, Ridgway had taken command. Walton Walker was killed, in fact, on his way to our brigade headquarters to present us with a South Korean unit president's citation, which, incidentally, we were not allowed to accept. For some reason, political, I think. We were told, and the brigadier had to reply along the lines of, "We forever bear in our hearts the memory of this citation, but unfortunately, as we have no equivalent medal we can give to a Korean unit under similar circumstances, we regret we cannot accept it." Something worse to that effect. There's a lot of nonsense, but there it is. So we didn't get our Korean president citation. At least we're not allowed to wear it. Now, Ridgway, of course, adopted an entirely different attitude, rather like Monty did in the desert, said, "No more withdrawal, we fight here." And by that time, the Americans were beginning to learn things, and so the line then held. And in fact, we gradually started to advance north, and we came to the area of Kapiong. And the spring was then starting, the snows were beginning to melt. Certainly on the southern slopes of the mountains, the snows were melting, if not on the northern slopes. And we were in Kapyong at the time of the Chinese Spring Offensive, when the Gloucesters, well, the 29th Brigade was about 20 miles to our west, were hit, and the Gloucesters were lost. We were hit equally hard, but I think our brigade was more tightly knit than the 20. I think 29th Brigade was rather more spread out, and the Chinese were not able to get in large numbers in between battalions. We also, by then, had the Princess Patricia of Canada's light infantry had just joined us. But I do remember that Bruce Ferguson arrived at brigade headquarters in a flaming temper, because the Chinese had in fact got into the Australian battalion command post, and amongst the things they destroyed was his caravan. He had a wonderful caravan mounted on an American 2.5-ton chassis, and this thing had been set on fire, and he was very angry, as any Bruce Ferguson could be. It really was a magnificent caravan. Now, we celebrated St. George's Day on, I think it was 22nd of April. The battle was growing great guns, and our gun lines were just behind brigade headquarters, so they were firing over our heads. And Billy Burke, who was then our brigade commander, Aubrey Code having come back home to command 2nd Infantry Division in Germany on promotion, Billy Burke had been the colonel of the 29th Brigade. They had a deputy commandant who was a colonel, and he came and took command of our brigade. When Aubrey Code came home, he, I think, came from the King's Regiment, and it was their tradition they wore a red rose on St. George's Day. So this wonderful Major Knight was brought into service again. Instead of bringing whiskey on this occasion, he was asked to bring a red rosebud from Japan, which he did. And we kept this hidden in brigade headquarters until the morning. And that morning, just after dawn, we presented it to Billy Burke, and he was wearing a woolly pullover. He put it in his pullover, and he was so proud of it, so delighted. Now, I think a little later on, it was the corps commander who arrived. An American, there were 3-star general, I think. 2 jeeps in front, everyone wearing tin hats, machine guns mounted. The general wearing a tin hat, grenades slung from his webbing equipment, and 2 jeeps behind with machine guns mounted. Billy Burke was carrying a walking stick, wearing gaiters, a beret, his woolly pullover and his red rose, and looked rather like a farmer. I think he had a 3.8 revolver slung around his waist. Looked rather like a farmer. And the corps commander said to him, "Buck, why are you wearing a red rose?" And Billy looked at him and said, "Sir, my regiment always wear a red rose on St. George's Day." And the American just could not understand it. He didn't understand it at all. It's quite beyond them. Well, then the Argylls were relieved. They had been relieved by that time. They were back in Seoul and went on a ship. I was asked to stay behind with the staff captain, because I had no family in Hong Kong or anything, until the Middlesex were relieved. And I came out of Korea with the Middlesex on the USS Mount Rail. Now, the Brigadier, Billy Burke, did not like Brigadier Taylor, who commanded 28th Brigade, who came to relieve us from Hong Kong. Somehow they didn't get on. I knew what happened. But he said, "Reggie, the whiskey we've got, it's got to come back to Hong Kong. Mustn't be handed over to 28th Brigade," which I was preparing to do. So the whisker was put into my Land Rover, because we had to take our Charles Land Rovers back. And we went down to Incheon, and we were loaded onto this large American battalion assault ship, the USS Mount Rail. And we went out in a landing craft alongside it. And this landing craft was bobbing up and down, and there was quite a swell there. And someone shouted down from the top of it, "Who's in charge down there?" So I said, "Well, I am." He said, "Captain wants you on the bridge." So I said, "Well, how do I get there?" And he pointed some little iron rungs sticking out of the side of this ship. So I climbed on the edge of this landing craft, and chaps were looking at me. I thought, "Christ, I don't like this at all, but I can't hesitate." So I jumped and caught these things and climbed up. Ultimately, I arrived on the bridge. Now, on the bridge, there was a senior officer, was a chap wearing khaki, with full Boyd Colonel's badge of rank and a tin hat, and smoking a large cigar. So I assumed he was a captain, so I saluted him and said, "Morning, sir." He said, "Hiya, captain." Now, can you imagine the captain of a Royal Naval ship saying to a captain, "Hiya, captain"? It's the way the Americans do it. They're totally different. However, we were told very clearly.